From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made the first time a woman in Rochester experienced homelessness. She was struggling with mental illness, and she was trying to learn the welfare and mental health system. Without a place to go, she turned to the Salvation Army. She stayed there for more than a week. Her journey then took her to more than a dozen stops, her father's place, Virginia to stay with a friend, back to Rochester, hoping to find stability, only to move among various shelters. And at every stop, she might have wondered if she could finally get the help she needed. Systems are hard to navigate. Without effective mental health care, homelessness is always going to be a part of life for people who are struggling. And finally, she got it. She got the help she needed. This hour, we're going to learn more about how that happened, how that has changed her life. We're looking at the connection between mental illness and homelessness. And we're talking about some of the things that are happening in Rochester to address these problems. Our guests this hour include, once again, Reverend Myra Brown, pastor at Spiritus Christi Church. Welcome. Great having you. Thanks for being here, Myra.
It's good to be here, Evan.
And also with us is Fana Tereke, who is an advocate for mental health awareness, who experienced homelessness. And Fana, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Reverend Brown, you met Fana a number of years ago in church.
I did. So Fana has been a parishioner at Spiritus Christi for 15 years. And so that's where I met her and her daughter. She has a little beautiful daughter, Sophia. And I've just been able and had the privilege of just kind of walking with her in different phases of her life and her struggle and being a pastoral support for her.
Well, before we get to that story, let me bring in just for a brief hello and a brief interruption from Megan Mack, who's the producer of Connections. We are in day two of our fall membership campaign. Hello, Megan.
Hello. Yes, day two of the campaign. We still have a long way to go to meet our goal. And I mentioned this yesterday, but I think it's important to reiterate. Connections is one of the few local talk shows in the country, and we're one of the very few, if not the only, two-hour talk show. So it is here in Rochester, listeners, that you're getting a chance to hear from guests like Reverend Brown and Fana this hour, important voices are in our community who have stories to share. That's not happening in every public radio station in the U.S., but it is happening here, and it is happening because of people like you. If you're proud of your public radio station, be a part of it. Think about how Connections shapes your day, how your conversations might be different if you didn't have Connections, if you didn't have Morning Edition, if you didn't have All Things Considered. So again, if you're proud to listen to WXXI, come be part of our family. Now is the perfect time to call because we're in the middle of a dollar-for-dollar match thanks to member Jeff Danielson. He is matching your dollars this hour. So if you call 454-6300, if you go online to WXXINews.org, it's a great time to pledge. Also become a new member. Be part of us, a part of our family officially. If we meet the goal of 50 new members today, a generous couple from Brighton will invest $2,000 in WXXI. So we really want to meet that goal, and we want you to help us. 454-6300, and thank you to everyone who has helped us so far.
All right. Thank you very much, producer Megan Mack. So I think, Pastor Brown, when we think about homelessness and mental illness, we talk a lot about homelessness. We don't always kind of do so in the context of this connection, which seems to me to be vital. How do you see it in our community?
Yeah, I see it really vital. I mean, one of the reasons that we started a mental health center at Spiritus Christi because we realized how important it is for people to have access to mental health services, because it can really lead to homelessness for people and really kind of freeze them in a space where they are without many options. And so mental health care is often the bridge for people to move their life forward. And without that, you know, we see the impact of that. You know, sometimes we see folks who are just, you know, sleeping under bridges. We see folks who are sleeping on city grates, you know, who are struggling with accessing mental health care. And so I think, you know, we see families, right, who are part of kind of programs throughout churches that are sleeping in places and struggling with homelessness. I think that we have to make sure that we have enough services to be able to help people move their lives forward. And so I just think that mental health care is really essential. It's really important to be able to, because you need it. You need your mental well-being to even be able to navigate the systems mm-hmm. that we have.
And that is such a catch, because think about trying to navigate a system on a day in which you're not struggling with any mental illness. And now imagine You're either struggling with poverty, potential homelessness, and mental illness, and you've got to figure out how a system works. Yeah. Well, that is a huge lift for anybody.
It is a huge lift, and most people can't do that on their own. I mean, we need mental health services to really, and for many of those cases, it's really an issue of life or death for people. You know, they either survive, you know, or eventually they don't survive. And so, you know, for us, I think it's just a critical service that needs to be available in this community and is available in many instances. I think Spiritus Christi Mental Health Center is one of those places, but there are many places throughout the city that's doing that amazing work.
What do you got coming up this weekend?
So this weekend we have coming up our annual River Walk, which is our fundraiser for the Spiritus Christi Mental Health Center. And it helps us to provide mental health care at no cost for those who can't access it otherwise. So after our 9:30 mass this Sunday, we will walk to Celebration Hall on Fitzhugh Street, where our main building for Spiritus is, and for lunch and kids crafts and DJs and photo booths after the walk. So we're asking for people to sign up. They can go to www.scmentalhealth.org/riverwalk. You can sign up there electronically. Your friends and neighbors can sponsor you, and it will help us to continue to serve the hundreds and hundreds of people that we serve through our mental health center every year.
scmentalhealth.org/riverwalk. We'll post it on our various platforms so you can check it out if you'd like, through the services that Spiritus Christi are offering in the community. So that's what's coming up, and that's on Sunday, you said.
That's on this coming Sunday.
That's coming up on Sunday. So Fauna was kind enough to reach out and share some of her background and story before the program began. And what I'd like to do is kind of talk to you about some of the things that happened in your life that I think really illustrate these challenges. Number one, I admire you for being here, and I'm really glad
to
see you're doing well.
I am.
And I'm thrilled to see that. And I appreciate you being willing to open up about this, because I know it's sensitive. And we don't want to have this conversation to exploit, but really to help educate and to illuminate and to empower. So you originally grew up, you grew up in Syracuse.
Yes.
Take me on the path in life that ended up in that situation, maybe before you ended up at the Salvation Army, but where you're struggling with various aspects. What was going on in life for you?
Well, at that time, when I left Syracuse, I was on a geographical cure. I went to different states, and I ended up in Geneva, actually Canandaigua, with my father, who actually introduced me to resources that would later on help me with my mental illness and, of course, my homelessness also.
How much did you understand about your own mental illness?
I didn't. I knew I was sick, but I didn't understand what was the sickness, how to take care of it. When I went to my father, I think we were both, learning about the system, the mental health system, the welfare system, resources that would support me in living on my own and eventually living on my own with my daughter.
And when you say, you know, you're trying to understand the mental health system and you knew you were sick, but you didn't know exactly how, did you know it was a mental illness? Were there things that were happening that you had moments where you thought, I have to get some sort of therapy or treatment or medication? How much did you kind of know?
Well, the thing is that I was undiagnosed at that time. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it was my father that introduced me to the mental health system and the welfare system. He was the start of my recovery. I was lucid enough to be able to know that I was symptomatic and that I needed help. But as of knowing what exactly was wrong with me, and I shouldn't say wrong with me, I should say what I was suffering from, I had no clue.
And so in those moments of lucidity, or at least times when you were lucid enough to kind of think about it, did you think about your future? Were you confident that you could figure out the system? What was it like dealing with the system?
Well, I had the support of my dad and my stepmother, and I went into the mental health system ignorant of what they could provide for me as a resource. I learned later that I was suffering from a mental illness, and it's called schizoaffective disorder, which is schizophrenia and bipolar combined. So it's a very serious mental illness. You can only imagine my situation, my state of how I was at that time without the treatment that comes with being diagnosed and being on medication and having a therapist and all that.
How did it manifest when it was really at its toughest points for you?
Before I came to see my dad, and sometime afterwards, I really suffered from severe depression for many years. I believe, you know, even though I had resources at my disposal, I suffered from certain symptoms due to some mismanagement of my diagnosis.
And so I guess I think you call it
schizoaffective disorder.
Disorder, referring to schizophrenia as part of the challenge.
It is.
How did the schizophrenia sort of play out or manifest in you?
Well, I had psychotic episodes that could only be treated with medication. It was, the timing. Schizoaffective usually, in schizophrenia in women, usually come to happen around early 30s. It manifests in early 30s. For men, it's early 20s, late teens, early 20s. When I came to my dad, I was about in my 30s, early 30s. So it's interesting that I feel that even though it really hit me in my 30s, that I may have had some symptoms a little earlier than that. But I'm not positive about that.
Yeah.
But it's known to hit early 30s in women. I came to be supported by my parents, and they did that. And like I said, I was introduced to the mental health care system. Mm-hmm. And I was diagnosed in Rochester General in early 2000. It was 2002, actually, that I was at Rochester General. And then I was transferred to RPC in 2003, and I spent 6 months. That's how serious my mental illness is. I spent 6 months in RPC, which is Rochester Psychiatric Center in Rochester.
Fauna, did it show up in hearing voices?
Yes, that's part of the psychotic episodes that I would have. I would hear voices, and I would not necessarily have visual hallucinations, but I would have audio hallucinations.
When you weren't having those, did you think, I mean, was that a frightening thing to have experienced? And did you fear the next episode? How are you dealing with that?
Well, the thing is that because I didn't know what was happening to me, I knew that I was sick, that it couldn't be normal to hear, you know, voices when nobody was around, you know. So I am grateful and appreciative of all the resources that are in Rochester, where I was able to go to Rochester Mental Health, which was the first agency that I went to, and find out that, you know, that I had a mental illness and that it needed to be diagnosed, and I needed medication and I needed therapy. And it continued to be something that was pronounced by other psychiatric stays, hospital stays, and other agencies. It's been a journey. It's been a journey full of doctors and therapists and medication. And, you know, it hasn't been the easy journey, but it's nevertheless the journey that I've had.
And you've gone to, I think your first shelter I'm reading was the Salvation Army. Was that
yes,
right?
Yes, I believe it was.
Okay. Just maybe a week, maybe two.
My first shelter, homeless shelter, that I stayed in.
What do you remember,
Rochester?
What do you remember thinking about that experience?
Well, I was so dysfunctional at that time because I was undiagnosed still. That when we were, you know, supposed to look for housing or jobs or whatever during the day to provide income and to provide rent money for a place to stay, and finding a place to stay, I would sit on the curb and I would sit there for hours until we were able to go back into the shelter. I had no clue as to how to even start the process of, you know, earning income and finding a place to stay. And it was difficult. It was very difficult.
Sometimes, Pastor Brown, we hear critics of the system, critics of certain programs saying, well, folks need to get a job. And I'm hearing Fauna's story and thinking, I can't imagine how she would have began to go out and even start looking for work, let alone dealing with what a job requires with the mental illness that she was experiencing there. I mean, there's a real disconnect in how to handle that, I think.
Yeah, most of us don't understand the complexities of that, right? So if you've always had your mental health and you think that it is that simple, that you just, you know, when you get tired of a situation, you just get up and you go and you do something different.
Sure. Just stop it. Get a job, right?
That's exactly right. But those are usually folks who've never had to deal with a mental illness. Those are folks who have not had to cross and navigate barriers like what Fauna is talking about. You know, the mental illness is a whole other world for people who have never experienced it. And so these are amazing people. You know, there's nothing wrong with them. It's kind of what Fauna says. It's what they have been diagnosed with, and it's a disease that they have, and it requires our support to help people walk from a place of struggling to maintain a sense of mental wellness, to getting to a place of mental wellness so that they can participate in the world the way that the rest of us want to participate in the world. And so they just require a little extra support. And so it's not as simple as, you know, come on, get a job.
Yeah, get up off the curb, get a job. Well, as Fauna describes, she did get admitted into RPC, the Rochester Psychiatric Center, got diagnosed, and eventually from there you moved into your first apartment.
Yes, I did.
But doesn't sound like you were there very long, or I don't know if I'm reading this
right. I was there for several months.
Okay, for several months.
Yes.
And then what was the path then? What happened next for you?
Well, then I moved into another apartment on University, and I lost that apartment due to losing my SSI. I had inherited money from one of my parents. They had died, and it was money that was left for me, and I not able to have that money and report it to SSI. My SSI stopped, and I wasn't able to pay for rent. So I left there, and I went to Bethany House, which is an emergency shelter for women on Clinton, on North Clinton. Actually, I think it's not North Clinton, but I'm not sure. They used to be somewhere else when I used to stay with them. And I stayed there for a month before I found my next apartment. And then I moved to the Monroe area. I gave up that apartment, the next apartment, because I became with child. And I wanted to be around people that I knew and felt comfortable with, and had my child at Bethany House again. I stayed there for several months. They were, you know, wonderful to me. They allowed me to stay there for several months, even though I gave up my apartment and did not become, you know, homeless, even though I was chronically homeless. My history had shown that. So I stayed there until I had decided to leave. And I went to Sojourner. Actually, I went into Women's Residence. And that is a women's shelter also. And I stayed there for some time. And then from there, I went to Sojourner House. And I stayed there several months, which is also a women's shelter. And during this time, I had my child. I had my child, and I was dealing with my mental illness, chronic homelessness, taking care of my child, learning how to take care of my child. And that was the start of my daughter's life, where, you know, we didn't have a place to live. I tried to attend school, but due to the fact that my mental illness was mismanaged, I didn't do very well. I took some time to graduate, but I did eventually graduate from Monroe Community College. And we moved into another apartment, which was sponsored by Catholic Family Center. And we were living on Burson and Culver. We had two apartments in the same apartment complex, and we lived there. But, you know, since, you know, the mental illness was not necessarily managed well, I turned to addictions. Many times when someone has a mental illness, suffering the symptoms of a mental illness especially, they self-medicate. We self-medicate. And we turned to addictions, whether it be alcohol or drug use or any other addiction. And I had turned to gambling. And I would spend my rent money on the gambling. And
where did you gamble?
In stores, lottery tickets. Mm-hmm. I would use my monies to do that. And I lost my place, my last apartment in the complex that was on Culver. And I moved into Voters Block, which is actually something that my church built and maintains now on West Main Street for people who are low income, suffering from mental illness and addictions and whatnot. And I lived there for a few years, and then I moved into the apartment that I'm in now, which I've been at for 5 years. So there's, I guess, a good moral to my story. You know, I ended up, you know, finally being able to get a grip, a handle on my mental illness to a certain extent, still, you know, living the journey. Learning how to manage my mental illness in better ways as time goes on. And I am able to divorce myself from the addictions and be able to pay my rent. I am, you know, functional where I do that. I have a diagnosis. I take medication consistently, you know. I am functional enough to know that I need to, and aware to know that my medication is, you know, a priority. And I take it every day consistently, like I said. I see a therapist. I'm in a depression group through Rochester Mental Health, and I have supports in place. I've been told that I'm quite resourceful, and I use the resources that I am able to use to the benefit of myself and my daughter. I continue to raise my daughter to the best of my ability and with the supports that I have. My story has a pretty good ending, and I'm thankful to the resources and the supports that I've had along this journey to be able to say, you know, I'm doing pretty okay right now. And I'm very, very, very grateful for that. It has provided a better quality of life for my daughter and myself. And we live one day at a time, like anybody else.
How's your daughter doing?
She's great. She's, you know, very strong. I'm sure she's watched me struggle along the way. And she has been flexible enough to realize that, you know, sometimes mommy has good days and sometimes mommy has bad days. And she is, I think, resilient in her own right. And she makes the best of it.
I think she's got a remarkably strong mom.
I appreciate that.
Modeling strength in remarkable ways.
Well, she's an incentive. She's definitely an incentive.
I hear that. Talking to Fana Tereke, who is telling us her story about mental illness and homelessness, and then the journey that has brought her to where she is today. And so you've got the backdrop now. And I want to talk a little bit about the medication. You say that it's important to you to take it every day.
Yes.
Probably everybody listening, if they haven't been in this position themselves, they can probably think of someone, a friend, a relative, who may be diagnosed with depression or another form of mental illness. And they could probably imagine or remember conversations in which someone said, well, you know, I don't think I need the meds. Like, I think I'm strong enough. Like, you know, I think I've been doing this for a year and a half. I mean, I've heard this from people I love. I've been doing this for a year and a half, been doing this for 2 years. I'm strong. I'm good, you know? What was it like for you after you got the diagnosis and you're on medication now? I'm curious to know if you can tell us a few things. First of all, did the medication essentially eliminate the psychotic episodes? And did you have times where you thought, well, I don't need this anymore. I'm going to go off it. I mean, what was that like?
Well, the thing about having schizophrenia is that it's a very deceptive illness. It will make you believe that you are okay and that you don't need your medication. So it's a difficult situation, whereas to, you know, being aware that you have to continue taking your medication. I think watching others make that mistake, other people who have mental illness, specifically schizophrenia, watching them stop taking their medications and where it's led them shows me that I need to continue to take my medication because I don't want to go down the same road, which is usually back into the system, you know, going into hospital stays and, you know, being sick and having symptoms, being symptomatic. I don't want to travel down that road, so I make it a priority to take my medication every morning, every night. And like I said, I have a dependent, and it's not just me by myself. That's another reason why I must stay on top of things to a certain degree, if that's the right word to use. I believe that medication and therapy, and right now I'm in a group, a depression group, all work together to make me okay to do the things that I need to do for myself and my daughter.
One of the things that I am aware of that Fana did that I thought was really genius on her part is that she made sure that she pushed and resisted the isolation that often happens with this disease, and she would often reach out to those that she trusted to have those conversations. You know, I just remember the many times that you would call me and say, you know, I need to talk.
Yes.
I need to talk about the voices that I'm hearing. I need to talk about whether I feel like I can do this or I can be successful in this. And so we found that it was really important to have supportive relationships, like at every juncture, that she could come in and be safe and talk about hearing voices or talk about feeling inadequate to move forward to the next, and have somebody who can sit with her in a non-judgmental kind of way and say, I believe in you, we can do this, right? And to just kind of unpack, you know, what else do we need to do?
So, Fano, you've met a number of people. You've been at a wide range of shelters and programs, services.
And emergency services.
Emergency
hospital
services.
Stays.
Yeah, I mean, you've been in a lot of different places. The people who are experiencing homelessness.
Yes.
How often and how routine was it for you, if you're thinking of it in this context, to think, well, this is someone who also has a mental illness? I mean,
yes.
How common, how routine?
Well, if you're asking if there's a correlation between mental illness and homelessness, there's a serious correlation between the two. I mean, just to navigate the mental health system and welfare system until, you know, someone is able to work either part-time or full-time, it's difficult. The thing is that when you have a mental illness, you know, there are limitations. And I think one of the things that I had to learn were my limitations. Even though I was raised to think that, you know, whatever you believe you can achieve, my thing is that with a mental illness, I have to be realistic and practical and realize that I have a mental illness, and that with the mental illness, my choices are limited. And being accepting of that. Acceptance is very important in all this. I would not have been able to get to the point that I'm at today without the support that I have, including my church. Myra has been a support of mine since 2004 and has helped me in many different ways. And I believe that with the supports that I have gotten, that I am able to do things within the mental health system and the welfare system, and to even work. I have worked. I have graduated from SUNY Empire State College with a bachelor's in public affairs. I'm looking for a job right now. I have just graduated this past summer. I'm looking for a job right now.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I think it's more of a, you know, a thank you to the supports that I've had and continue to have. I wouldn't have been able to do what I've been able to do, because when you have a mental health illness, you're not functional. If you're undiagnosed, you're not functional, and it's very difficult to do what you need to do. Like I said, your choices are limited. You don't even know you have choices when you have a mental illness. Mm-hmm. I have been, like I said, blessed with supports, and not everyone that has a mental illness has supports. And when we see someone on the streets, you know, that person has a mental illness, most likely. Addictions, being functional, to remedy the homelessness, problem. So I am fortunate to have the supports that I've had to help me and guide me through the systems that I've spoken about.
So lastly then, as we think about the journey you've been on, as you say, you're still on.
I'm still on.
You know, you're looking for work now. Give me a little picture of what you'd love for to be doing and life to be like 5 years from now.
Well, accepting the fact that I have a mental illness and that I have limited choices, I don't really think out 5 years from now.
Okay.
I'm more of a day-to-day person, more of a, you know, I assume with optimism that I will be even in a better place, will have a start of having a late career, helping other people, maybe in the same situation. Either in peer support or as my major is public affairs, something in public affairs. So I will be hopefully in a better situation, mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, and even financially. My daughter will still be living with me at that time, and she will be in high school. And hopefully she'll follow in my footsteps and go into college. With my daughter, the challenge is being a good example, you know, to her, and making sure that I'm living my life to the best of my ability, and that you know, even though I have a mental illness, and she knows I have a mental illness, I'm not keeping that away from her. I think it explains some of the things that happen in our household. She's not ignorant of that fact. And I think it helps her to put names to things that happen. She does the best that she can to live with me. You know, she's a great kid. Like I said, the challenge is living as a living example to her. But 5 years from now, I hope with optimism, like I said, we'll be living even a better life. Mm.
Kids can be so inspiring, can't they?
Oh,
I think we underestimate
very
kids
much.
Sometimes.
Very much.
We underestimate them sometimes.
Yes.
And I do think Pastor Brown, that was a very interesting answer, you know, where she says, you know, she's not really thinking. And that's important. You know, she's had, here's Fauna's remarkable story, and she's got to think 24 hours, day to day. But here we are now, and I just want to ask you one question before we get our only break of the hour, which is this. You think about our community, the employers in this community. I'm not making hiring decisions, and I'm not running some of these organizations, corporations, government entities, et cetera. And I know that someone like Fauna, who is really self-aware, understands her mental illness. The mental illness can present challenges, but at the same time, if you want someone who's resilient and strong, here it is. What would you say to employers who have to make decisions about creating opportunities or offering opportunities to people like Fauna?
Yeah, I think that I would say that they should all do it. That's what I would say. I should say they should all do it. I think that employers who don't think about that are really kind of cheating themselves of really amazing leaders and depth and insight and wisdom. As I listen to Fauna share her stories, I mean, there's a level of self-awareness that people who don't have struggle with mental illness do not have. There's a level of honesty. There's a level of integrity that is developed, that has been developed through her journey and through her story. Like, you'd almost be crazy to not, no pun intended, but you'd almost... You'd be causing your own loss organizationally to not consider hiring somebody like Fauna, who just needs a chance, you know, to make a future for her and her child, like I've needed that chance, like you've needed that chance, and our listeners have needed that chance, right? And so we have what we need organizationally within businesses to provide the supports that people need, and to work on our own, work on stepping away from these stigmas that we've learned through the years that have kept us from hiring people like Fauna. And so I feel like it's our work to do organizationally, and it's the work of the business community to do, to prepare itself to welcome people inside these organizations like Fauna.
The remarkable story of Fauna Tureke is part of our conversation this hour as we talk about the intersection of mental illness and homelessness. Pastor Myra Brown is here from Spiritus Christi Church, and we're talking also about some of the things coming up this week and this weekend as Spiritus Christi has expanded the work they do to offer mental health services as well. So let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll also get some of your feedback and phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, Adam Bellow sits down with us in studio. He's running for Monroe County Executive. Later this week, we sit down with Cheryl Donolfo, the incumbent, who is running for re-election. This week, it's a chance to hear both of them at length for an hour, answering our questions and yours in advance of Election Day. Adam Bellow, Wednesday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I'm going to read an email first, and then we're going to get Wendy on the phone. So, Wendy, if you're there, just stay there for 1 second. But I think I'm going to start with this email, some feedback from listeners, because Fauna's story illustrates how mental illness can come first and lead to homelessness. This email indicates the complex ways that joblessness and an economy that's deeply unequal can impact mental health. Let me read this. Hi, Evan. I wanted to add another layer to this conversation. I have never been homeless, and I don't claim to speak from that experience, but I can tell you what poverty and joblessness does to mental health. I was a college graduate with a good job. but in my early 30s, I lost that job. For roughly a year, I could not find a job, and I was on unemployment. I had family issues to deal with. My modest savings dwindled to nothing. At that point, I became afraid to check my bank statement. I didn't want to know. I feared for the future. I withdrew from my social circle. I lost touch with friends. I didn't respond when my family reached out. I was deeply depressed. I was deeply down the hole of self-loathing. I was embarrassed. I couldn't ask people for money because I had too much pride, but I could no longer pay my bills. Today I'm doing much better, but I gained an understanding of the complex ways that someone's mental health suffers when they are facing poverty, eviction, and related issues. It's real. It's very, very difficult. Thank you for having this conversation. Name withheld. And that, I appreciate that email very much. So Pastor Brown, that is the, if we're doing the chicken and egg thing, what leads, that is a situation where someone in an unequal economy and loses work, and then starts to feel that depression kind of creeping in and takes them out of their social circle, takes them out of their family life. What would you say to someone who has been through that and to listeners who may be experiencing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think so much of our identity is tied to our ability to work, right? And our ability to provide for ourselves and for others. And so when you lose that opportunity or that ability, you really, what I hear in that, she kind of started losing more of herself, right? Because her identity was really tied up into that. And that does impact your mental health and your sense of well-being and your sense of worth. And you know, I could feel that slow walk towards isolation and anguish around it. I think that... I think we have a responsibility to make sure that people who want to work can work. And I think that we have to have the kind of services to pull them back at any point in her story. You know, appropriate services could have stood the chance to pull her back to a place to remind her that she's more than just the work that she's doing, and to, you know, to have safety nets in place for people, you know, so that they can survive, to not leave them steeped in poverty and destituteness.
Yeah, and Fani, your story, you strike me as someone who did seek out places to go, people to talk to, whether it was your father. Also, when you were pregnant, you were seeking a community where you would feel comfortable.
Yes.
Delivering the child. So what would you say to people who start to feel isolated, like they can't talk to people?
Well, when you have particularly depression, you definitely begin to isolate. And it's a phenomenon in itself when you're trapped in this mental thinking that, you know, either you don't need help or you don't want to have help. And I say it in that context because isolation is detrimental to asking for help. You know, the phone weighs 1,000 pounds when you're depressed and you're isolating. To get out of the isolation, it takes support from other people sometimes to bring someone into, you know, mainstream and, you know, living the best life that they can live. But I understand what this person is talking about. I had severe depression for years, and I still experience severe depression off and on. I isolate. But there is something within me that doesn't allow me to isolate to the point where I am completely on my own, that I'm away completely from friends and family, which I'm very blessed to be able to, you know, to have, because I know I have the supports. Mm-hmm. I know that the resources are out there. And I have always been able to connect and somewhat stay connected to those resources and that support.
I appreciate that email, and I appreciate anyone who's struggling with that, feeling like they won't be accepted or friends won't understand. I hope you've got, hope everyone listening has got people around them who understand and love them no matter what the circumstances are.
Evan, if I could just say please. One other thing that I saw in that email is there was this theme of a fear of the stigma.
Yeah.
Right. Created a, for me, that theme comes up again. Right. The stigma that we allow people who are struggling to feel just because their circumstances have changed. Like, I think we can do better than that. Right. We have to do our work to get rid of the stigmas and the ways in which we view people based on what they have and what they don't have. I just felt the pain of that as she wrote that email.
Wendy in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Wendy.
First of all, I want to say hi to my favorite barista. Hi, Fauna. It's Wendy.
Hi, Wendy.
And second of all, I just I went through a really deep darkness, like a period of severe depression this summer. And I have worked from home for a long time, and I think I was able to get through it better because I was working outside the home. And everything to do with having to show up for people helps me when I'm depressed. Anytime I have to say hello to anyone, it's just one step up out of my little spiral into myself. And so one of the things I was really interested in hearing about is, I don't know if either of you got to, any of you got to listen last night to Retro Report. They had a report about a man who was studying people who were suicidal and the effect of just sending them letters saying, we're wondering how you're doing. I think about myself. I'm a person who in when I'm in my best moods, I reach out to a lot of people. But when I think about it, I probably have over 200 people who I'm friends with on Facebook. And Facebook decides what I'm going to see of whom or whatever. If somebody drops away and isn't out putting themselves out there, how do I know who needs to be reached out to? Is there any way that the systems that deal with people with mental health could improve in their outcomes by building in more after care, outreach is what, I guess what I'm saying. And I'll take your answer off the air.
Wendy, thank you very much. Myra, Fauna, you want to address that?
Well, that's interesting that she said, you know, aftercare is important. It is important. I mean, it can't be just the hospital stay and then you go into the community and you try to live your life basically on your own. There needs to be mental health services in place. Many a times, especially now, they have case managers that work with people who live in the community, and they do home visits. But it's very important to be hooked up to these resources. And usually people with mental health issues that have had hospital stays are hooked up to these resources while they're in the hospital. Then, you know, usually what happens is that they're in agencies that have psychiatric nurses, psychiatrists, therapists, people, a team that basically works with you. The thing is that, you know, what happens is that there's a downward spiral, and many times people are caught off guard and are isolating. The disease, the illness is baffling, powerful, and cunning. And it involves staying connected on both parts. But if the person that has the mental illness stays connected by having aftercare services, that's the best bet. And that's probably what would work for someone particularly who suffered from depression and isolates.
And we got about a minute and a half. I want you to, if you want to address that, that's great. We also want to squeeze in what's going on Sunday. Go ahead, Myra.
Yeah, so I was just going to say that I agree with Wendy. I think as a pastor, follow-up and check-in is really crucial. You know, we found that as a as a pastor, if you don't see a parishioner who hasn't been there in, you know, a few weeks or a few months, right, it's really important. And we try to put that in the queue in our mindset to reach out to that person and check in with them. And it's a way to break into that possible isolation. Maybe they've had an illness that you don't know about. So I could see where that's a huge value for the mental health community as well. And so for us, again, I think all of this conversation has said and solidified for us why it's important that we do the work that we do at Spiritus Christi Mental Health Center. And so this weekend, if you are a walker and you want to support this kind of work, we would love to have folks go to our website, www.scmentalhealth.org, sign up to be a walker, get some sponsors so that we can continue to provide mental health care at no cost for those who can't access it otherwise at Spiritus Christi Mental Health Center.
So, and the walk is on Sunday?
The walk is this Sunday, right after the 9:30 Mass, around 11 o'clock. But they could join us for Mass, or they could come at 11 and follow us over, and we'll get started.
SC as in Spiritus Christi, scmentalhealth.org. All the information is there. And Reverend Brown, you always amaze us with the work that you and your community does, and we're so grateful. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
And Fana Tereke, it's been an honor to meet you and to hear your courageous story and to see the success that that you're having now. I'm
Thank you. Just
privileged to have you.
I'm honored and privileged to be here.
No, it's great having
Thank
you.
Thank you.
And good luck to you and your daughter. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Great team of connections today. David Griffin doing great work on the phones today. Thank you, David. Megan Mack is the producer. Rob Braden is the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. This is member-supported public radio.